This interior, unspeakable language, is sometimes called the language of communion, the unutterable speech of the immortals, which poets try in vain to reach and express, which music, with its unsearchable attributes and great powers, very nearly approaches when your love is warmest and deepest, when you meet it in another, or when it meets you, then you catch the rudiments of this infinitely finer, this inexpressibly beautiful, this transmundane, this celestial, this heart-emanational conversation, which is so divinely blissful, so spiritually refreshing, and so exalting to all who dwell under its blessings in the summer land. Let it be once more affirmed that words are not the most eloquent expressions of the soul. There is no joy so intense as that which sparkles in the eye and crimsons the cheek, yet refuses the aid of the voice. There is also no grief like that which does not speak. Where the heart is a tale to tell, how poor are the utterances of the lips. Need we these ever to tell us that we are loved? Is there not something in arbitrary signs that breaks the spell of our sweetest feelings? There is a mental electricity more mysterious far than the subtle fluid that thrills through material substances. Its conductors are the soft light of the human eye, the smile of the human lip, the tone of a subdued and earnest voice. Pleasant, indeed, is the solitude that is broken only by this silent speech. Concerning traveling in the summer land. Traveling there is, at first, just what it is here. Arrived, we use our legs and feet, we see with our eyes, hear with our ears, and we also touch, and smell, and taste things, just as the very young child does on being introduced into this world. The mind of everyone is interested at first in what is most external, and yet, what is called external there, is here even too deep for mankind's comprehension at the present time. When arrived there, you find yourself in possession of higher senses, in every respect similar to these, and with the same attributes and faculties, only more susceptible, and with the essential habits and inclinations of your character even more active. These all begin to call for their complete gratification. They lead you along the vernal margins of musical waters, or you traverse different beautiful fields, or away you go on attractive excursions, all in accordance with the most powerful necessities of the ever-active, never-dying, always youthful spirit. Now and then you meet persons who are still laboring with the effects of unearthly sadness. These undeveloped souls remain with organizations, or become members of brotherhoods who have not yet arisen out of the depressions of terrestrial mishaps and imperfections. Everyone goes to appropriate and congenial places. Let your mind be duly impressed with the fact that great minds, so called while on earth, often lose what was considered the properties of their greater reputation. It is instantly stripped off from some of them, and they are not known, named, nor bowed to as it distinguished persons. Great men, so styled on earth, are of no consequence in the summer land, neither king nor queen, nor prince nor princess, and known as such, for all go the clad in their true peripherical garments, and not in the costly habiliments you procure at Stuart's. When arrived, you will appear dressed and adorned, plainly or otherwise in rigid accordance with your internal nature and status. Thus Henry Clay, when he reported himself in the city of New York more than 10 years ago, said that his great earthly, political, attainments had not availed him much. This distinguished American gave a message to a number of personal friends. His communication, which was perfectly verified at the time, shows the mental condition in which the statesman found himself soon after his arrival. Next headline, Henry Clay's message to a number of friends. In July, 1852, the following, with much more of high significance, was delivered, "My worldly wisdom availed me not when my new life commenced. It is very beautiful to become a little child again, and now I understand the meaning of the words, ye must be born again, and in true sincerity and gratefulness I feel that I am born again, in a life where the vanities of earth have faded from my view, and the bright glories of heaven are opening upon my soul. O soul made pure, be thankful for thy high estate, and adore thy God who bath endowed thine eyes with light, and thy soul with the ability to enjoy the pure beauties which crowd upon thy new existence. And yet how I am overwhelmed with the foreshadowing of the glory which is yet in wait for me. But now a form of brightness appears, and saith unto me, As thy day is, so shall thy strength increase, and thou shalt grow and wax stronger in the stature of wisdom and the might of love. I am surrounded by those who are, like myself, exploring the wonders of this heavenly land. The realities become more and more transcendently sublime as we proceed. And the beauties of knowledge are increasingly unfolded, more vast and commanding becomes the widespread plain of glory, as we travel on in our heavenly path, guided by wisdom supreme and love unbounded. The mind is overwhelmed, as Henry Clay expresses it, with the unexpected naturalness of the post-mortem existence. Persons who read this, I think, will not be as much astonished as was the sage of Ashland, who ascended from the old Kentucky state. He was not astonished in the halls of Congress at Washington, he could easily grasp the great rising propositions before the government of his country, but when he entered another mansion in the Father's house not made with hands, then he became as a little child, guided by wisdom and love. Persons sometimes change their views rapidly, and they hasten to return, saying that they have experienced a change in their convictions. Dr. Emmons, who was a preacher of the old school doctrine of eternal punishment, comes back after having thoroughly investigated the geography and government of the Summerland, saying that there is no place hot enough to suit his sermons. A message from Dr. Emmons, in Boston, 1851. You of the earth may pretend and think you believe ever so strongly in eternal punishment, but when you bring it home to your own hearts, and those you love, the strongest terms you dare to use are, we leave them in God's hands. He doeth all things well. Yea, verily, I respond to that with all my spirit powers, God doeth all things well. Amen and amen forever. Saith the spirit of Dr. Emmons. Does not that very remark imply a doubt in the minds of those that thus speak? You could not better express your doubts, if you would, your firmest, strongest believer in eternal punishment, dare not say of the one he loved, he or she hath gone to hell. In plain words let us speak, for you that believe it may not shrink from speaking it. I was one of the old school, a strong bold preacher of the doctrine of eternal punishment, would that those sermons were buried in oblivion. They are a curse to the world, a dishonor to the memory of him who could believe or utter such sentiments, a libel on the character of a just and holy God. And yet, as my spirit returns to the friends and scenes of my earthly days, often do I hear the words I uttered in life brought forth as the faith of a good old man, and by those, too, who cherish my name and memory with almost holy reverence. I long to make my voice heard in tones of thunder, that they may know the truth, and not grope in darkness longer. Again, the celebrated American author, J. Fenimore Cooper, in the year 1850, gained access to an elderly gentleman in western New York, and reported in brief as follows, I little thought, when, a few months ago, I was investigating the developments that were interesting some of my acquaintances, that I should so soon be seeking an opportunity to make my identity manifest. I was astonished at what I then witnessed, and was afraid to investigate, lest I should find true what others said, and what had been so marvelous to me, because I dreaded the scorn of those whose good opinion I valued. Hence, you see, I was not well prepared for a high mansion in the spirit life, for I felt ashamed to seek the truth wherever it might be found, and such cowards are not fitted for high enjoyments in the spirit world. Yet I was introduced into a state far better than I deserved, for which I feel thankful, and that feeling of gratitude, as it is cultivated, I feel advances me. Some spirits report themselves as they were, or as they appear just before death, in order to satisfy their remaining relatives that they are still in existence, and that death was not the extinguishment of their personality. A remarkable case is reported by Professor Brayton, 11 years ago, showing how entirely simple, yet terribly impressive, is the method which some departed ones adopt, to cause their identity to be fully known to acquaintances who yet live in the body. Next headline, case of identification. Mr. S.B. Britton, in the year 1852, put on record the following: last winter, while spending a few days at the house of Mr. Rufus Elmer, Springfield, Mass., I became acquainted with Mr. H., a medium. One evening H., Mr. and Mrs. Elmer, and myself, were engaged in general conversation, when, in a moment and most unexpectedly to us all, H. was deeply entranced. A momentary silence ensued, when the medium said, "Hannah B. is here." I was surprised at the announcement, for I had not even thought of the person indicated for many days, perhaps weeks or months, and we parted for all time when I was but a little child. I remained silent, but mentally inquired how I might be assured of the actual presence. Immediately the medium began to exhibit signs of the deepest anguish. Rising from his seat, he walked to and fro in the apartment, wringing his hands, and exhibiting a wild and frantic manner and expression. He groaned in spirit, inaudibly, and often smote his forehead and uttered incoherent words of prayer. He addressed men in terms of tenderness, and sighed, and uttered bitter lamentations. Ever and anon he gave utterance to expressions like the following: "Oh, how dark! What dismal clouds! What a frightful chasm! Deep, down, far down, I see the fiery flood. Hold! Stay, save them from the pit! I'm in a terrible labyrinth. I see no way out. There's no light. How wild, gloomy! The clouds roll in upon me. The darkness deepens. My head is whirling. Where am I?" During this exciting scene, which lasted perhaps half an hour, I remained a silent spectator. The medium was unconscious, and the whole was inexplicable to Mr. and Mrs. Elmer. The circumstances occurred some 12 years before the birth of the medium. No person in all that region knew aught of the history of Hannah B., or that such a person ever existed. But to me the scene was one of peculiar and painful significance. The person referred to was highly gifted by nature, and endowed with the tenderest sensibilities. She became insane from believing in the doctrine of endless punishment, and when I last saw her, the terrible reality, so graphically depicted in the scene I have attempted to describe, was present, in all its mournful details before me. Now, the testimony of Professor Britton would probably be taken as unquestionable and trustworthy on any other subject, and perhaps at this late day his word will also be accepted in this direction. In the whole realm of psychology, or of sympathy of mind with mind, there is no known law that will explain the effects he delineates. But those who have held communication with the Summerland, find that those who still earnestly desire to communicate, take the first opportunities to stamp the impression which would produce the strongest conviction of personal identity upon the remaining relative or friend. I suppose there are 2,000 instances, all of them substantiated so far as human testimony can go, showing that spirit communications are literal facts recorded in history beyond the possibility of refutation. Some minds who on earth were intellectually interested in ideas, and entering the second sphere, begin to communicate, as soon as possible, to impressible persons remaining, the fact that, in their cogitations, they had conceived of something like what they now beheld and that they are so glad to find that the realities of the higher life are even more gratifying than they had dared to expect. To illustrate this point, I refer you to the testimony of Margaret Fuller, given in 1852, a year remarkable for the outpouring of this peculiar description of communications. Testimony of Margaret Fuller, otherwise Countess Ossoli, December 5, 1852. "My sojourn on earth seems now as an indistinct dream, in comparison with the real life which I now enjoy. And I regard the raging of the elements which freed my dearest kindred and myself from our earthly bodies, as the means of opening to us the portals of immortality. And we behold that we were born again, born out of the flesh into the spirit. How surprised and overjoyed was I when I saw my new condition. The change was so sudden, so glorious, from mortality to immortality, that at first I was unable to comprehend it. From the dark waves of the ocean cold, and overcome with fatigue and terror, I emerged into a sphere of beauty and loveliness. How differently everything appeared! What an air of calmness and repose surrounded me! How transparent and pure seemed the sky of living blue! And how delightfully I inhaled the pure, life-giving atmosphere! A dimming mist seemed to have fallen from my eyes, so calm and so beautiful in their perfection were all things which met my view. And then kind and loving friends approached me, with gentle words and sweet affection, and oh, I said within my soul, surely heaven is more truly the reality of loveliness than it was ever conceived to be by the most loving hearts. Already are my highest earthly impressions of beauty and happiness more than realized. Here you remark a vivid contrast between this communication of Margaret Ossoli's and that reported by Professor Britton. In Margaret you see a mind retaining its characteristics in the transcendently ideal. She reports the intense gratification which came over her idealizing faculties immediately on her introduction to the better land. But the other lady came back purposely to impress upon Mr. Britton's thoughts and feelings the fact of her presence, not through ideality, but through the frightful gesticulations and paroxysms of a painfully remembered insanity. Traveling in the post-mortem sphere is at first just like pilgrimizing on earth. But the higher inhabitants have acquired what we shall never be able perfectly to imitate in this world. They have the power, without wings, to rise up and put themselves in harmony with the currents that sweep through the atmospheric spaces. With the spread of light they ride on those currents millions and trillions of miles. It is accomplished by the marvelous power of inherent will. The ability of the will to check the pulse is a promise of ultimate achievements. It is possible to develop and educate this inherent power of will. By it, in this world, we lift our heavy bodies from beds or chairs, and cause them to move on the ground through low space. It is a mental power holding insensate muscles to its rule. This executive energy of the arisen human spirit, instead of wings, is the secret of its lightning flight. I do not say that spirits travel by a continuous exertion of the will. They seek the upper currents by will, somewhat like the balloon excursion which occurred some few years since between St. Louis and the northern part of this state. Professor Wise speaks positively of the existence of an unvariable current, and thinks that if the venturesome aeronaut could strike it, he would be rapidly and safely carried from west to east. His first experiment was a failure, as all first experiments usually are, but it sufficiently illustrates what is the universal method of traveling in the summerland, when they depart on their faraway excursions. They gain that particular current which sweeps away through the spaces between the orbits of the planets, and which takes them with the celerity of thought to the destination which they desire to reach, however remote it may be from their point of departure. We shall not obtain that method in this life, save by uncertain balloons. We see the lesson and the example in birds. But that is done by a direct exertion of the will, and by sympathetic contact of their swift-moving wings with the electricity of the air, part float developed by friction, and part momentum developed by will. Just as a message of intelligence can be sent through space by vibrating the telegraphic current over thousands of miles, so the spirit body and will can, by the vibration of the celestial rivers which flow between the summerland and the different planets, mount and float and ride upon them with inconceivable speed, and gain any desired destination. Traveling there is social. In the New Testament you read with wonderment and with longing the report of the Pentecostal experiences. How could such things be unless there were spirits invisible, who gathered as in convention, and, by one united effort, baptized with sublime zeal whole congregations of spiritualists in Syria, in Palestine, in Rome, or wherever the upper Pentecostalians happened to be in contact with the lower assemblages of sympathizing and impressible minds. The spiritualistic congregations of the old time were supposed to be baptized by the outpouring of the Holy Spirit from the great Jehovah himself. That was the shortest explanation furnished by the converted Pharisees. They always furnished the most literal explanation of spiritual phenomena. Thus Moses imagined that he never could be visited by any power less exalted than the great Creator himself. That was the Hebrew mistake. Many of them have not yet unlearned the error in this world, and some in the Summerland have not changed their sentiments. But the truth is, that a combination of minds, just like ourselves, coming in contact with earthly congregations, pour out the spirit of real love, uplifting, elevating, giving inward gladness and unity of feeling in the bonds of peace. By permanent magnets I sometimes illustrate the law that spirits impart communications with whom they can enter into direct contact, and with none others. Hence some have passed all the way through life without receiving a single evidence that any such thing as a spirit exists, while others have felt it and known it from their earliest recollections. I well know that there are minds who have not felt the blissful influence of such spiritual contact, and of course, have no evidence whatever of the truth of these things. And yet such persons are many times helped and saved by proxies. Guardians cannot reach them, save through the agency of other parties, a succession of intermediates, the way a great variety of special providences come to pass. As an example, I give the case of an African woman, to show that the benevolent in the beautiful brotherhoods of heaven still watch over the lowly and unhappy of earth. How a famishing African woman and child were saved by their guardians. The case is cited from the Moral Instructor of 1850. It exhibits interposition, sympathy, and calculation, to a remarkable extent. A lady medium in this city, whose name we are not at liberty to pronounce, while walking in the streets, in her usual physical and mental mood, was approached and controlled by a spirit, caused to enter a bakery and purchase some victuals. Thence led out of the city by a circuitous route into the suburbs, where she met a colored woman sitting by the roadside, weeping, with a small child by her side. She was traveling to find friends, and, destitute and exhausted, she had sunk despondingly down to bewail her condition. Using the organ of the medium, the spirit said to the sufferer, "Sister, why weepest thou?" The reply, in substance, was, that she was away from friends, and had no means of procuring food for her famishing child, making no mention of her own privations. She said she had knocked at the doors of those who appeared abundantly able to bless, but had been refused even the morsels that fell from their tables, and now despaired of succor. The spirit then gave her the bread, telling her that her afflictions were known, and that he was an angel sent to minister to her wants. Overjoyed, the poor woman fell upon her knees, essaying to offer the spirit a prayer of thanksgiving. But he said, "Thank not me, but God that sent me." The medium was then conducted home, having been unconscious during most of the transaction, and retaining only an indistinct recollection of the bakery, one or two points in her road, and the meeting with the woman. Many a man has been saved from committing suicide, by his guardians, by the intermediate method of approach. Why are not all men saved from their temptations and indiscretions? Because they can be neither directly nor intermediately reached. Of necessity all such must walk through great agony to a higher intellectual and moral condition. It is the impulse of their inward being. Guardian angels see that it is better for some children to fall down a whole flight of stairs than to be rescued. For the one sad accident or stumble may save them from the misfortune of 40 other worse falls and blunders in the course of their lives. The saving and protecting arms are not thrown around some gentle natures simply because there is no contact. But what a beautiful law and system of providences are sometimes displayed. Here is an example, a man saved from suicide by the interposition of his guardians. The following authentic case was reported by a New Haven gentleman, in 1852, many years ago. A couple of gentlemen, who were roommates, graduated at Yale College, and became ministers of the gospel. At an after period they settled in the ministry in different states, and carried on a friendly epistolary correspondence during a large portion of their lives. One of them was in the habit of receiving impressions upon his mind of that vivid character which usually constrained him to comply with the dictate of the moment, or suffer loss touching his wonted peace. And though he was seldom able to divine in advance what the result of his compliance would be, he was always obedient to the dictate, and afterwards saw clearly that he had only done what duty or interest would have demanded. Among the many occasions upon which he was called to act in obedience to this higher power, the following is singular and instructive, and shows, in the language of Cooper, after he had been foiled twice on the same day in his attempts at self-destruction, that God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform, that he accomplishes his purposes by ways and means unthought of by man. A vivid impression came over his mind that he must, without delay, get upon the back of his horse, and with all possible speed reach New Haven, a place which he had not seen since he left college, and one that was many miles distant. As had been his custom, he was obedient to the impulse, and reached the place at the midnight hour of a dark night, and finding it greatly altered from what he had ever before seen it, and not descrying any suitable place to stop at, he was induced to ride to the door of a small house, in which he discovered a dim light at the attic window. After knocking and waiting a considerable length of time, he heard footsteps upon the stairway advancing slowly. Soon it opened, and a man, with a lamp in his hand, and with a stern countenance, and corresponding voice, demanded, "What do you want here at this unseasonable hour of the night?" The messenger of life, as he proved to be, replied, "I can scarcely inform you what I came for, I am a stranger here," after which a short pause ensued, and the man with the lamp, in low and quivering accents, said, "I will tell you what you came for, it was to prevent me from committing the atrocious act of suicide. When you knocked at this door, I was putting a rope around my neck to hang myself. Your knock broke the spell, and I have now neither desire nor power to destroy my life. Do you not read in the Testament that Saul, mounted on his horse and at the head of a vast army, was bent upon persecuting the spiritualists of that day? He was determined to ride them down and then exterminate them. When he had very nearly reached the point where the desperate conflict was to occur, the scales began falling from his eyes, and he tumbled from hip horse to the ground. He was taken away by some friends, and remained in an unconscious condition for some time. When he came to himself, he was a convert to spiritualism. He felt ashamed, and said he had been entirely in the wrong, a short-sighted old sinner. Now what is the difference between the modern spiritual case, put in modern language, and this ancient case related in the New Testament? The law is identical. A combination of truth lovers in the spirit land, who are loyal to the divine principles that regulate the universe, directly accomplish these results which men call special providences. The facts of the overthrow and rapid conversion of Paul are no more mysterious, when analyzed in the light of modern spiritualism, than was the modern transaction of saving the lone man from suicide. Neither can you say that the New Testament facts are better substantiated by witnesses than are the analogous facts of today. Here is another instance of special impression, an engineer impressed by his guardians. The following statement was published in the Caledonian, January, 1853, and is, therefore, testimony from an editor not committed to spiritualism, Mr. Butterfield, who was killed by the late unfortunate accident upon the Passumpsic Railroad, for a week or two before it occurred seemed impressed with the idea of some impending evil. He mentioned his impression to his friends, appeared downcast, and did not wish to run an engine any more. Indeed, he had gone so far as to say that after that week he should leave the place be occupied on the road. He was ready to do anything else but to act as an engineer. In passing up a few days previous to that on which the accident took place, before it was daylight, he whistled for the train to break up, insisting that the fireman should go forward and examine the track, for he plainly saw the figure of a man moving slowly along. He also stopped at another, and about the same time, believing there was a man on the track. It turned out in both cases to be an illusion. If Mr. B. had been a timid and nervous man, these impressions would readily be accounted for, perhaps, but he was just the contrary, cheerful, cool, deliberate, and fearless, so far even as to be remarkable for these qualities. His impressions, viewed in connection with his well-known character and melancholy end, are certainly mysterious, and we do not know how they are to be accounted for, unless it be that evil is sometimes portended to man by a superior intelligence. Spiritualists, instead of rejecting the Bible, find in its pages experiences that are identical with what in these days has become well nigh universal. In the Apocalypse of John you read marvelous descriptions of events and awful things which would happen if there was a fair chance for such occurrences.